Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my finest friends. Welcome to Rahalastava this week with the extraordinarily talented Mae Martin. A brilliant person as well. I really enjoyed chatting with her. I'm delighted to see her doing so well, and you should catch her sitcom, new series coming up very soon, and her stand-up. She is, and a book, absolutely brilliant. We are doing live Rahalastavas very, very soon, May the 24th, with Jeff Norcott and Sarah Kendall, possible Taskmaster champion after me. As I record this, I'm still the Taskmaster champion. It's looking good for her, but anything can happen in that last show. May the 31st with Johnny Vegas and Jesse Cave. We've also got gigs on June the 7th. No guest books yet. June the 14th with No Such Thing as a Fish and To Be Announced. And July the 5th with Robin Asquith from the Confessions films and much, much more. Really going to be worth your time. Why don't you come and see them in an actual theatre? That would be marvellous. Go to richherring.com/gigs and you can see all the links and all the confirmed guests. There's a socially distanced audience for at least the first 4, but we can still get 350 people in this big theatre, so I'd love to see you there if you want to come out and experience real live comedy for the first time in a long time. You can also watch on live, it's live streamed, and if you've enjoyed these podcasts over this last year, if you've enjoyed these podcasts over the last 10 years, if you've enjoyed all of my podcasts over the last 13 years, it would be lovely if you could live stream one of these shows at least, just to give a little something back. It's also a big help to the venue, the Clapham Grand, help them get back on their feet. But I'd love to see people there. It'd be fantastic to have as many people in the venue as possible. So please come out. It's all safe and socially distanced. richardherring.com/gigs. Do you remember we are doing retro Rahalastavas on Fridays with some of my favourite guests? We've had Stephen Fry and Bob Mortimer repeated on Fridays. This week coming up, Kathy Burke. It's a great place if you're new to the podcast to catch up on some of the old ones. If you're old to the podcast, it's a good way to catch up on ones you will certainly have forgotten. I've forgotten nearly all of those ones from that long ago. Also, it's a great way to support us financially. The more people who listen with the adverts, the more money we have to make more podcasts. You can't say fairer than that. So if you've got friends who haven't yet got into this podcast, please tell them maybe about those retro ones. That's a good place to start. You are, of course, welcome to go back and listen to any of the old ones, but it's hard to wade through the hundreds and hundreds of podcasts I know that are there. Anyway, thanks very much for your support over these difficult times, and sit back, relax, and enjoy Rahalastapapa with Mae Martin. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man who's being haunted by a giant inflatable Boris Johnson. It's Richard Herring. Hello. Hello, my fine friends. Welcome to another episode of Richard Herring's Large Stinky Tumor podcast. It's called that this week because they sort of told me on the phone how big my cancerous tumor was. I'm sure you're keeping up with this news story. But I hadn't really taken it in. I knew it was quite big, but they sent me the dimensions of it in a letter this week. And it's, I think it's 6 centimeters by 4 centimeters by 4.5 centimeters by 2 centimeters. And, you know, that's difficult to imagine nobbling around in your ball sack. So I don't know if this is inappropriate. I've used some of my daughter's. Oh, no, look, that's quite exciting I didn't think about the green screen. That's the size of it there. And look, it's sort of like it's the ghost of my testicle flying around there. That's how big how did I not notice that in my... It's the entire ball, but then my ball was not that big, I have to say. It was big, but it wasn't that big. It's like it's been overtaken by the Borg of cancer, and there it's all out. It's fine, but that's quite horrific. I don't know if it's worse that I've made that of my daughter's Play-Doh. I don't know if that's the worst thing about this or that I've just made it at all, but I wanted to get a visual representation, and that is terrifying. Do check your bits, everyone. That's my annual reminder. I was talking to Jeff Upton from New Zealand, who's been going around. I'm not cock obsessed and ball obsessed, but he's been going around drawing penises and balls on holes in the road to try and encourage the New Zealand government to mend the potholes. They've tried to arrest him, I think, it's for his diligent work. But he's my hero. He calls it Rahalastapa anyway. As well as my ball news, the thing that caught my eye in the news this week, I'm surprised I didn't mention this on Twitch of Fun last night, was that in Iraq they had a reality show in which they mocked ambushes of celebrities by ISIS. It's quite full on. So they literally... I mean, it's getting impossible to parody. Back in the 90s when we parodied TV and how it might go, this was the kind of thing someone would have gone, what about if someone pretends to kidnap people? But like literally they pretended they were driving them into a zone and they passed through a checkpoint. And this is a country where obviously kidnappings by ISIS happen quite a lot. And so celebrities, actors and soccer players they were taken in and they would actors kidnap them and bound them up and stuff, including fake weapons and stunt explosions, while the militants threatened to detonate fake suicide vests. And then some actors pretending to be the army came and rescued them. And, you know, they've got into trouble for that in Iraq. Some people think that's a bit sick. But, you know, that is... If they all enjoyed it. They all enjoyed it. Is that fair? I don't know if that's a good idea to put people through something as terrible as that. I'm sure my guest will have some views on that. So look, we're going to crack straight on. What's lovely is we're doing this in the afternoon, which is quite a rarity. Usually do this in the evening. We're recording this on a Friday afternoon and drinking tea and feeling very relaxed. So it's going to be a very different kind of Rahalastapa. My guest this week is probably best known from her appearance on Word of the Year 2017. That's why we know them. That's they're best known for. Though, according to IMDb, they were also the production assistant of Late Night with David Letterman in 1990, though that would have made them 3 years old at the time. So I'm not convinced IMDb has got that right, but we are about to find out. Will you please welcome the incredible Mae Martin, ladies and gentlemen. Hello.
Hello.
How God, are you?
So much to discuss just off the back of your intro there. The tumor. How are you feeling?
I mean, I'm feeling fine. It's out.
It's enormous.
It's been out for like 2.5 months, and I had chemo a month later, so I've had chemo about 6 weeks ago. Yeah, it's unbelievably big. But the thing about having it in your testicles is they're on the outside of your body. Yeah. And so not officially part of your body. So it wasn't anywhere else, thank God, but it hadn't spread anywhere else. But it's also a very curable cancer. So I've, as unlucky as I am to lose one of my testicles, I still have another one. And yeah. It's, yeah. As you can see, and as you all know as a comedian, there's an awful lot of material to get out of it,
100%, mate.
I'm going to be writing about it for the next 2 years. I mean, so it's,
And your daughter's Play-Doh. Yeah, amazing.
I mean, there's so much going on. I'm good.
The kidnapping thing, that's apparent. You can pay to have people kidnap you. It's like a fetish, and people pay, and it often goes wrong, and the cops get called because they'll come up in a truck. It sounds like I've really looked into it, but I haven't. And they'll just throw you in the back of a truck and take you somewhere, and yeah. So then often people see this and call the police.
Yeah, or fight back, or so, you know, like that's what I've watched quite a few. There's a couple of films, the Borat film, and there's another great film called it's better than the Borat film. It's on Netflix. It's called something like Bad Trip or something which is basically doing stunts and making a film out of it. Both of those things are basically, Borat, I'm going to call him, wore a bulletproof vest during his same stuff. But they're doing things that you think in America, where people have guns, must be genuinely really dangerous because someone could fight back. With that situation, if you were kidnapped by ISIS and you might fight back because you think, I'm going to die anyway. So
100%.
It could lead to terrible. But it's sort of, you know, where'd you go if you're going to parody reality TV? There's nowhere left. Unless people genuinely, I mean, I always thought it'd be quite good to have a panel, you know, a quiz show or a reality show where there's maybe 100 people taking part and one of the people is going to be executed at the end of it, but the winner will win like £1 million.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, and you've got to think, is it, well, you know, that's sort of, there's a 1 in 100 chance of dying of testicular cancer. So there you go.
Yeah.
So like, I'm in this game show.
Oh my God.
And would you, I think people would still take part with those odds. I think people would, you'd find 100 celebrities. It's a celebrity thing. You wouldn't necessarily have to kill them at the end. You'd just say you were going to, but
it'd be
quite cool to.
To test people's resolve like that, yeah.
Yeah, and then kill one of them, kill the worst one.
Yeah, throw them in the bin.
So that's that's the only thing I can think that is too far for TV at the moment, but we'll come back in 10 years and we'll see.
Yeah.
But let's talk about you. I don't want spoilers if people haven't seen it yet. What was the word of the year 2017?
Oh my God, I'm trying to remember. And I think... So I'm having this memory that I was asked to film like a sort of VT about the word of the year. And it was, I think it was that, is it a Danish word? Hygge?
Oh, yes.
Like H-Y-G-G-E. And it's like, it means coziness, right? And that sense of being at home. But they had me interview this Danish interior decorator. And I think I just got the tone of it all wrong. It was actually one of the worst things I've ever done on TV.
Good. I'm glad I picked it out. That's what I... Why didn't they pick Sophie Hagen for that? Why did you... How did you get the call for that and Sophie Hagen didn't get the call for that?
That's a really good question.
It wouldn't happen now because of cultural appropriation. We couldn't do that. It was a different time back in 2017.
Yeah.
Where that was fine. You could get a Canadian to talk about Denmark, but you can't do that now.
Yeah, and I kept making sort of bizarre sexual innuendo things. I just really misread... the tone of the whole thing. It was kind of a family show.
All right, we'll look out for it. And were you on the production side of Late Night with David Letterman in 1990? Is that you?
Yeah, I was a really precocious 3-year-old, and they were trying to attract a younger audience, and I was
Well, you were quite a precocious child, though, so it's not. I was pretty sure it wasn't you. I mean, if it had been something before me, I would have believed it. But you did start doing... I'm fascinated by this, by comedians who start very young. And you were 13 when you started doing stand-up.
Yeah.
And there are some that do it and disappear. And then there are some that do it and carry on. And you're obviously in the latter group. So you've got 20 years of stand-up experience, which is sort of incredible. But
really bizarre, yeah.
What drove you to start that soon and have the balls... As you know, I shouldn't really say that because I have only got one. The ball.
I think
the bravery to do that.
I don't know. I think probably the same thing as all of us is this kind of gaping chasm inside and yearning for approval and validation. Like like most comedians, but maybe mine just started younger. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think I was really extroverted and much more than I am now. I'm quite shy now and introverted, but I was a really loud kid and doing a lot of Ace Ventura impersonations and just sort of found this improv class and then started going to clubs. And yeah, I genuinely don't know what made me think, yeah, that I could do that.
And did audiences, were you introduced as being a 13-year-old or?
Oh,
so
yeah.
Did people warm to that? Or were they nasty?
They were sort of, it was like, you know, seeing like a monkey in a suit on a unicycle. It was like a sort of circus act type thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, the intro would always be this long thing about my age and I'd come on often in my school uniform and I got away with murder. I didn't have any jokes or good material or anything. But you're not going to heckle a 13-year-old, are you?
I don't know. I just think you might. I mean, you know, I'm trying to think. There was a guy I remember who did Edinburgh and often it's someone's, when they're that age, their dad's what kind of wants to be a stand-up comedian and writes them a
right.
set. And I remember a guy, and I can't remember his name, who I think that was more or less the situation with. And I think maybe it's the UK. It just seems so precocious that I think maybe he did get a hard time.
Right.
I was writing comedy at 13 and I was probably putting on shows at school around about that time, but I don't think I would ever, even if there had been any clubs in Cheddar in Somerset, which there weren't anywhere near,
I've been to Cheddar Gorge. I love Cheddar Gorge. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very, it's all shut down because of COVID and it might not open up again. The gorge is always going to be open because that's a natural feature, but the caves are closed. So it's very, very sad.
I think I didn't get heckled because I was kind of palpably vibrating with vulnerability and like I was never like an aggressive comic or even an observational comic. I always just spent, you know, was making fun of myself and being quite pathetic, so
yeah
that's a good way to deflect heckling, I think, if you're already kind of on the verge of tears.
Well, it's good, you know, but it's such an extraordinary thing to go in and be good. And I've seen the clip because there's a clip of you at 16
doing a character.
Mm. But honestly, you know, I had John Kearns on the other day, and one of his student gigs, you know, I found, and it was, you know, it was all, there was some stuff in it, but it wasn't very good, and he would have been about 20, 21. As for a 16-year-old, it was this incredibly assured, really well-acted character. The audience, I think, don't know even though you've been introduced under a different name, and clearly it's a character, I think the audience aren't clear about whether it's a character or not, and are a bit, laughing but a bit confused, I think, but it's really funny. It's really good.
Thank you. Yeah,
really good. Like
the audience wasn't sure what was going on there. Yeah, that was I did the character called Catherine Butchko. I called the character that, and that was just the full name of a girl in a school that I'd gone to, and I'd really idolized her, and I'd felt like she'd bullied me. Looking back, I don't even know if she did, but I didn't think twice about using her full name on TV wearing her school uniform. And then it was only later that I realized, she'd been really upset by that.
There might be. We did that a little bit. Someone bullied me at university, and we, a little group of guys in my college, were sort of just rude, you know, nasty to me. And we end up using their names. And one of them rang up after he rang up the BBC, and I could hear him talking to my producer.
No way.
Saying, he made the actor use my mannerisms, of which we didn't. We just named the nasty character, you know, an idiot character after him.
Yeah.
And he was really cross, and we got away with it. I think if it happened now, he would have sued us. We'd probably been.
Well, also, like, those names from your youth and childhood, it's always a full name, and they really are burned in your memory. And if it's a slightly unusual name or whatever, you've got to use them. I think
it's a good name. Well, but you've done that. I was wondering that a lot because there's another routine you do about one of your first boyfriends who dumped you over a speakerphone.
He's called
Ian Peach, and it leads on to extra stuff. But in the gig I saw, a woman, you said someone, there was some recognition from the audience, and it seemed a woman in the front row had recognized the guy.
Yeah. I've been doing this story about this guy that broke up with me when I was 13 or something, called Ian Peach. And I've been doing that joke for a year. And then, of course, the one time it's televised, this woman in the audience, I sort of rhetorically went, Ian Peach, anyone know him? And she went, yeah, I do. It was in Canada. And she really did know him. She went, yeah. And so after the show, I was like, just please don't tell him. That's how pathetic. I'm still talking about him. I was 13. But his name is actually spelled slightly differently to.
Okay.
Yeah. So that has helped me, I think.
It sounds like a comedy name. I mean, it's a great name. Mm. And it sounds like a comedy name that I would have made up as the man who invented peaches. But I can't talk. My name's Herring, but the idea of someone being called Peach seems very funny to me.
Yeah.
It's bizarre that would happen in the one that's televised. But you don't think, I think Stuart used to do it as well. Stuart used to literally name his ex-girlfriend's mother and have her name in the act and was really rude about it.
Oh my God.
And I think that, but I think then when he was on TV, they made him change it. And I think, or maybe he realized it was, if you do it on TV.
It's sketchy. Yeah.
You suddenly might get into a bit of trouble for libel. Even back then, people realized it, but there we go. But, look, are you also, I've got very much into ventriloquism over lockdown. So I've got a lot of puppets, which I know your dad's got a lot of puppets, but I also found out that one of your first performances was as a ventriloquist dummy. Is that true? That I read that in The Guardian? Is that?
Yeah.
That so was, what?
I was 11 and it was actually my godmother took me to a comedy club called Yuck Yucks in Toronto. And I was this very sort of gangly, androgynous 11-year-old. I wore like a suede waistcoat and a bow tie. So I looked like a ventriloquist dummy already. But I went and sat in the front row and everyone kept commenting on this weird kid who was there. And then the headliner got me up on stage. I was so thrilled. And he sat me on his lap and made me his ventriloquist dummy. And but he thought I was a boy. So he was making me say all these really filthy things about Pamela Anderson and stuff. I was loving it. But then at the end, he was like, you've been a good sport. You have anything to say? And I was like, I'm not a boy. And then, maybe that's where I like got the bug, because that got a huge response from the audience.
Yeah. Well, my comedy epiphany was when I was about 4 or 5 and doing the puppet show with this puppet here that I now use in my acts as well. This is you looked a bit better there for my nan and my mum. And, I can remember that first laugh and they were obviously laughing at how sweet and cute I was rather than my material.
Yeah.
But I just remember being behind the sofa and hearing this laughter and really thinking, this is what I want.
Yeah,
it's what I want.
It's such an electric feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I just thought every comedian I saw at that age, I just thought was a rock star. And yeah.
But like Canada, I've noted this before. A lot of the Canadian comedians that I've interviewed and met there's quite a wild bunch of usually guys, but they're quite heavy drinking, drug taking sort of wild guys usually.
Yeah.
So as a 13-year-old and a teenager, you were going to clubs and working alongside guys like this and being treated by them as an adult or as an equal, or was it?
I would like to think that just wouldn't happen today. I think if there was a teenager in a green room with me now, I'd call their parents, or I'd be, you wouldn't party with them, would you? Yeah, but I definitely did. It was very strange, very confusing. I thought it was, these were my real friends, and in a way they were, but in a way also, how can they be when there's that huge power imbalance with the, and generational divide? So, yeah, it was a bit of a strange, I wouldn't recommend it.
Did they look out for you? I can imagine comedians are, as we know, a weird bunch of people. I think they're largely quite nice, but not all of them are nice. But also whether they would care enough about anything like that, or did they just get on with it?
Well, that's a good question. I dropped out of school when I was 15 and then I started working in the building in the box office. So then I really sort of felt like part of the furniture at this club, Second City. So I think people definitely forgot my age. And so, yeah, there were a few people who really did look out for me and I'm still friends with, but then there were other people who, dated me and gave me drugs. So,
yeah.
So no, it was a real mix, but I think it really, if you put a teenage person in any industry, there'd be a handful of vampires,
No, of course. But, you did get quite heavily into drugs, obviously, at a young age, and that became sort of, we've seen in your later work, and you've talked about it and written this fantastic show, partly about it, a TV show partly about it. I mean, do you think you would have gotten to, do you think with that kind of child, you know, teenager that you wanted to experiment, you seemed like you were, I mean, I was very, I didn't take drugs till I was in my 30s and then hardly at all. You know, I was really risk averse. I didn't like the idea of losing control, but I was just terrified that every experience would kill me. So drugs were just like, I'm not doing that. I don't want my brain to change. I don't want to die. But you'd have, do you think you were, you're the sort of personality that would have got into that?
I think so. Yeah. I felt really invincible and also frustrated and uncomfortable in my body and sort of angry and all of those feelings. I really felt like the world was mad and I didn't understand it at all. So I think I was doing drugs at high school as well. And then there was a lot of cocaine in Toronto in the comedy scene at that time, and there really isn't anymore. It was just this brief moment where it's quite a small community in Toronto and quite cliquey, and there was just tons of coke, and I just got really into it. So that was bad. But in a way, it's weird because I think comedy, although it was sort of destructive in one way, it also then saved me from the depths of, you know, pretty serious addiction later on, because I loved comedy and I was ambitious and I wanted to do well and I wanted to, you know, and I did have real friendships there. So it's both.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of interesting in the UK, I think, because my generation of comedians, I mean, there was cocaine and stuff going around, but I could have had some if I'd wanted some, although I was never really... I wasn't really very, I wasn't very sociable and I felt like a bit of an outsider, and so I didn't really... If I knew that that was going to go into that situation, I wouldn't really go into it. But there was a lot of boozing, I think, in my, you know, I think the 90s comedians were sort of more booze.
Right.
And maybe some coke. And then it feels like, you know, your generation comedians in the UK at least feel very clean, like they had
very
to
clean.
Stay clean so that they would, you know, could do the 10 years of work it takes to get on TV now, which I think in the 90s, you know, you could do a year or two, be good and get onto TV and not have to work that hard.
Yeah. And, I read something the other day about just the younger generation coming up and how clean living they are, and they're not having sex really, and they're not doing any drugs, and so I think things are changing and it is good. But when I started, you could still smoke inside in comedy clubs, and I felt like I got the tail end of that old school kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was in 2001 or something, so it was like just the tail end of that old culture.
Yeah,
and I remember getting actually booed off stage for. I was 16, and it was a New Year's Eve show, and I went on with a cigarette, and that enraged the audience, which I kind of get. I think I must have looked really arrogant, and I sort of thought I was Mitch Hedberg, and and everyone was dressed up really posh because it was a special New Year's Eve gala or something, and I was just wearing my, you know, I was like homeless at the time, basically, so I looked like shit, and I got booed off the stage. Fair play, you know.
Well, you've definitely been through it. I mean, we'll talk about. I mean, it's been really, really lovely this week to kind of, I knew your stuff and I've seen you and we've gigged together a couple of times and, you know, I was aware of you, but it was good to really kind of delve deep. I listened to your audio book, which is, Can Everyone Please Calm Down, which is, I think it's great to listen to the audio book. My wife said she had it on Kindle and that it was very badly formatted on Kindle.
So really?
Quite hard to read, yeah.
I'm so sorry about that.
So she did read it, I think, but I think you're very good. Just so you let your people know, but people should listen to it on audiobook because it's sort of like a stand up show anyway. Really,
very much.
It's sort of three hours. It's a nice length of audiobook, but also I think to get the author doing it, and I think you bring a lot out of it in your personality, and it is fabulous. But it's what I think is interesting at listening to it as a 53-year-old man is, you know, I think the book's aimed at younger people, right? But it feels to me like my generation need to have the book much more. I don't think the younger generation really need the book, do they?
That's exactly right. Yeah. And so when I was doing a book tour for it, and so speaking to a lot of young people, and they were totally like, yeah, we know, you know, it's a lot about sexual fluidity and the way we're headed, and it's quite positive, and they were all, yeah, a lot of them. Oh, it's just so different to when I was in school. You'd get questions at the end and you'd get like the jock, like this. I remember this guy asked a question and he looked like the most popular boy in the school, this ripped kind of football player
teenager boy, and he was like, yeah, how can I be a better ally to my trans friend? I was like, fuck, that's incredible. It's so different. So yeah, you're right. I think it's good for parents, and I hope so.
Well, it'd be great if they, you know, I think it's not a subject that I think I'm kind of up to speed with a lot of it, but it's also, I think the minute you just hear this stuff discussed, and it's both true of your TV show and this book, it's just because it immediately makes this kind of weirdly contentious issue, because, like, you know, I think the title gets it, and everyone please calm down. Yeah. It shouldn't be that contentious about people identifying what they are and who they want to be with, and, you know.
Totally.
It's not a contentious thing, being in love with people. And you would think, my generation would have been, you know, in terms of gay rights, most people would have been, like, very on board with gay rights.
Yeah.
So it sort of seems so weird to me that those same people can't get their head around it just being, like, a couple more,
I know,
slightly different areas. But it's
you know what, it's like, there's been such a backlash, hasn't there, just in the past few years with it. It's like there's increased visibility around these things, and then this big backlash, and it feels really like there's these insidious kind of political forces that are co-opting these issues and using them to polarize people and to make this really fraught public conversation around them that's just so crazy, because it's, we're talking about such a small population of people that are so under threat, and so it's just wild. And so I hope that I'm able to, like, particularly with Feel Good, with the TV show, like, just show the kind of more human, chill side of it.
Yeah. Well, I think that Feel Good and Schitt's Creek, I think, really do it in that they both have, like, you know, gay relationships at the center of them. And it just immediately feels, you know, it's a normal relationship.
Yeah.
It's two people in love arguing, getting, you know, falling out, whatever. But it isn't at all strange or alien. You know, it's and I think that just to show it, just to see it, it hopefully can do loads and loads of good.
I hope so. Yeah, and yeah. I think people have to also be, it has to come from within the. I mean, people have to be allowed to ask questions and not understand it too, because it's just changing so fast. I understand that people get kind of a sense of vertigo about it. So, yeah.
But, you know, I don't know. I wonder whether it's, like, I think there's, I've been thinking about it quite a lot, because I think there's the kind of cool people who are cool when they're teenagers and then they get older, and you kind of wonder, actually, was it always just, I'm looking out for myself, you know? So, like, they're cool teenagers and they're left wing, and they're going, why are there people rich and why are there people oppressing people? And then when they get rich and get power themselves, they're looking out for themselves, and they haven't actually changed.
Yeah.
They were always just going, oh, this one suits me because I'm at the moment I'm poor, or whatever. And I wonder also whether it's, you know, it made me think about, you know, how different things were. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, and things were really different, and it was very repressed, I think, and certainly in terms of homosexuality or any gay, you know, gay was just a word meaning
bad,
bad and homosexual.
Yeah.
And both those things were terrible. And to a boy and that time, it was, you know, you really had to go, no, I'm not. And the if you look at sitcoms from, I mean, even to be honest, into this century, often in America, comedy films, the main joke for a guy is another guy's touched their leg and then, I'm not. So even now, when you'd think things have moved on, but it's,
you're right, it's pretty recent that, we forget that. And so people they get kind of tired of all the conversation around it and the increased visibility and stuff. But yeah, you're right. It's important to remember, A, how recent that change is, and B, like, it's still illegal in more than 70 countries in the world. You know, that's huge still. So it is still important.
It's right at the heart of someone of my generation, still at the heart of, you know, and if you haven't gone, okay, this is a bit weird why it's so obsessed with this. But I think there's a part of me that goes, okay, you know, I wonder if some people, like, resent a younger generation because they've got freedoms that my generation didn't have. Whether there's an element of sort of that people are so angry about it sometimes, you go, why are you so angry about what someone else is doing? With the people who get so upset about trans rights as well, I mean, I go, how much has this ever impacted on your life? I don't think most of them have ever met a trans person, you know. It's not a huge thing in their lives, and yet they make it a huge thing in their lives. I wonder if it's just that sort of envy, and also why wasn't I? Because I feel a bit. Listening to your book, I feel it's a shame that because it's not just that, you know, for any sexuality, for any gender, wherever you're placing yourself at today on that spectrum, you know, there are, as you say, that, you know, if you identify as straight, then you will. There'll be things you do that are still like weird and inverted commas compared to what people expect of that. So it's, you know, it does speak to everyone, that book, I think.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. I really think a lot about, like, oh, I know you do lots of stuff about men's mental health and stuff and talk about it. And that's like, I mean, that's this strict kind of gender binary that we enforce and these really kind of sort of old fashioned ideas about masculinity and stuff that they really harm straight people more than anyone, and they're just as constrictive and like suffocating, and you know no one's living up to those ideals of masculinity and femininity. So it can only be a positive thing for everyone, I think, if we get less gendered about things, slightly more inclusive, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, no one's forcing anyone to do anything they don't want to do.
Exactly.
I mean, if that's happening, that's bad. But as long as that's not happening, it makes me sad. It makes me sad to see people who were, you know, in inverted commas, cool in the 90s. And then you see the stuff they're spouting now.
Yeah.
And as a middle-aged person, that kind of terrifies me. You think, is there a day you just wake up and turn into an utter prick? Or how can you, you know, because like even the sort of LGBTQ plus thing, the number of people who, you know, make jokes, and I'm sure I've done it as well, to be fair, about not being able to remember what the letters are or how many they're gonna, it's really not, everyone remembers Rahulastapa, so they must be able to remember LGBTQ, even if it changes a little bit, you know. So
Isn't it the same number of letters as RSPCA, isn't it? Yeah. It's like not that hard, but also...
There's a Q in there. That makes it harder, though, because Q is such an unusual letter.
It is unusual, yeah.
And plus. But, you know...
I mean, I worry about saying the wrong thing, and it's because there's this like, sense that it's such a sensitive thing that it's scary to engage and ask questions and talk about, and I even, like... When I'm on stage, I'm thinking, fuck, if I use the right word there, you know. So, yeah, we all do need to chill.
I do, and I think that's part of it. I think part of it is the fear of, you know, certainly talking to my parents and stuff, they sort of fear saying that they're good, decent people. Things were different when they were younger in lots of different areas, but they fear saying the wrong thing. And it's almost more that, and I suppose the reaction of going, how dare you get it wrong, rather than going, hey, come on, let's work together to try and get this right.
Yeah.
It was maybe pushing them away. But I really massively recommend it. It's it really sort of encapsulates all this. I know you wrote it a couple of years ago, so I've heard you say you think it's out of date already, but it does, you know, I think it's using humor. But I love it when, you know, Sarah Pascoe does it, and I suppose I do it a bit, and writing a sort of serious book that's a book about a serious subject, but from a comedic point of view. So there's loads of laughs in there. It's great.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah, I was thinking before doing this that, like, the last time when we were doing gigs together, I think I was doing musical comedy. Like, I mean, I was doing such different stuff, and I'm such a fan of yours, so I'm really relieved that you've seen the more recent stuff, because I remember just bombing on lineups with you at some festival. And
Yeah. I don't remember you bombing, but also I wouldn't, you know, that's what it's like when you watch, when I watch that thing of the 16-year-old, you're going, this audience should be way, they're giving this way more. This is so impressive. Like, it's so impressive. And they know that you're like super, you know, super young, and they, you know, you are much cleverer. So as long as, you know, you can tell, but you know, that's, that, I think it's, you know, you're finding your way. That's why I think it's interesting start, because I couldn't have started doing professional comedy, you know, or in a like adult environment as a 13 or 14 year old. I think even coming into it as a 21, 22 year old, I think you're sort of you're removed from like a big chunk of your audience, right? So like, yeah, a lot of your audience are old, you know, they're not massively older than you maybe, but they're 5-10 years older than you.
They don't like being told something by someone younger than them, for sure. And also, you don't know who you are yet. And
no,
for me, I spent a good decade trying to be cool, and that's the enemy of comedy, right? Is
I think so. I think it is, and I think it's interesting with you, because like your backstory is so different than how you come across now.
Oh, thanks.
And I think that's because, you know, I mean, you've changed, I presume, but you know, and that's also interesting, because people do change and people learn. You know, I think we're unforgiving of the mistakes people make, especially in their teenagers. But you know, you learn from doing these things. Hopefully, if you get through them in one piece, and then, you know, you seemed in a way that, like a lot of people who are into drugs when they were young, I've seen a lot of people go properly off the rails or just become a bit crazy, or you know, not, maybe it's because they don't give it up in time.
I think that might be partly it. I mean, even when I was doing really bad drugs, I always was this kind of goofy weirdo. I was never sort of like scowling in the corner. I was always kind of just I don't know, didn't know what was happening.
Sure. But anyway, it's great. Well, I love the fact that you've talked about this a bit, I think, before, but you were into Bette Midler as a youngster. But again, that really kind of chimed with me, because like, I remember I was always sort of so interested in those feelings and in sex. Yeah. But again, it was a very weird, the people who I liked, I remember liking Nana Mouskouri, who you won't remember, who was a sort of Greek middle-aged woman with really big glasses.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, Barry Manilow. Yeah. I was really into. And then the lead singer of Sweet, who you probably won't remember, and the blonde one from ABBA, the female blonde one from ABBA.
So I had so a very specific
as a 4 or 5 year old. I had a very, you know, eclectic, and so that's, you know, again, I sort of think, oh, you know, that was some, you know, that's like I was ready purest, to experiment.
Yeah,
with every type of person.
Totally, when you're that age, and before the world tells you who is the you know, supposed to be fit, and it's
Bette Midler
really
is simple. Bette Midler is a more attractive prospect than Nana Mouskouri, I have to say,
right. But
it's still quite an unusual choice, because when you were watching her, she would have been like, again, quite middle-aged.
Oh, mid-40s at least, yeah. And I think she sort of embodied this kind of outrageous, like, femininity that felt so untouchable to me. Like, it was so different to how I felt. She was just this mysterious kind of goddess. And she has a kind of drag queen energy, doesn't she, sometimes?
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, I think I was attracted to the flamboyantness of it. And, I just couldn't believe – I was obsessed. I still don't know if she – I did this stand-up special on Netflix, and everyone was tweeting at us both, it's got really graphic descriptions in it of like dreams I had about her, and I wonder if she knows I exist. I'd like to think that she'd be okay with it.
I think as long as you're not sending them directly to her, I think it's okay. But I think it's weird enough being mildly in the public eye, where the sort of the things that sometimes people feel comfortable sharing.
Yeah, do you think a little bit weird. If you met Nana Mouskouri, would you still have rumblings?
I don't think for her. I mean, Barry Manilow was a big, but weirdly, I think both of them appeared in at the time. They were just quite long adverts in the middle of, like, it feels like children's TV or daytime TV in the 70s, where they were doing compilation out. I think they were both from that, and they were quite long adverts. I think Barry Manilow might be more of a problem for me. There was just something. Certainly, well, Brian Connolly, the lead singer of Sweet, not the comedian, has sadly died, so I'm safe from him.
Yeah.
I think, you know, but is it Agnetha or, yeah, I think it's the ABBA lady.
Oh, yeah, is she alive?
She's still alive, but she had a weird stalker who she ended up in a relationship with.
What?
And it was, but then so basically it just, I don't know the full details of this, check online.
I'm going to Google that, yeah.
But he basically kind of stalked her a little bit. But at the end, because she was living out sort of in Sweden in the middle of nowhere because she was a bit of a recluse, and I think he moved near to her, and then they started having a relationship. And my memory, I may have got this wrong, and this is probably from Emma Kennedy because she's obsessed with shit, but I think he was... I think he was collecting her turds from the bathroom. So even though he'd got there, he was a stalker. He managed to get in a relationship. I mean, this is a good sitcom, right? I think we should write this as a sitcom. A stalker who ends up in love with.
But he still wants to do the stalking. Like,
he still wants to do the pervy stuff.
He was obviously just enjoying the act of stalking more than it didn't matter who it was. There's a museum in East London that's like a museum of curiosities. Victor Wynn's Museum of Curiosities. And it's just this weird basement filled with weird kind of gothic objects and curiosities. And one of them is Kylie Minogue's poo. And I always think, how did they get it? And who got it? And why? And I don't know if someone just stumbled. Someone was cleaning her dressing room and found it. But yeah, I'd like to believe it.
Did they just write to all the celebrities and say, we want a bit of your poo for our museum? And she was the only one who sent some back.
Yeah, she was like, all right.
We're going to make a poo museum. That's a good idea. We got two good ideas straight. We've just spitballed two great. We got the stalkers marrying their victim and the poo museum, celebrity poo museum. That could be a game show.
Yeah.
And then people have to guess the celebrity poo from... Yeah, it's like
I really like that.
It's like through the keyhole, but it's through the asshole.
Yeah, what it is. There you go.
We've got it. Got it.
Who's it? Pete Doherty would just be like lava. It would be some horrendous, toxic substance.
I mean, if you had to, but also, my poos are so inconsistent, and some of them are good. You know, I would be proud to put them in a museum, but some of them, I don't want people seeing that one.
Yeah.
Down the line, so it'd be quite the burden put on you of having to provide the perfect sample for that you knew was going to be seen in a museum for maybe centuries to come.
Yeah, I'd spend a few days,
sifting through. Just eating
right,
good food.
I have a friend who has a phobia of just a hypothetical scenario where she poos and she looks down and the poo is white, all white. And it's just a hypothetical. I don't think that's a thing that happens to anyone or anything, but she's terrified that one day her poo will be all white.
Right.
Like chalk.
Because that used to be the observational comedy joke again of the 80s and 90s, maybe, or maybe the 90s, was where's the white dog poo gone? Because there used to be white dog poo.
Oh, really?
I don't know what the reason is. There must have been something they were feeding to dogs in the 70s and then they stopped doing it and then you'd never see white dog poo again.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, so maybe she's heard that joke and then worried that could happen. If it can happen to dogs, it could happen to humans.
Yeah, definitely. No,
this is a good conversation.
Yeah, this is good stuff.
It's a shame to move on from it. So I'm not going to. Now I want to talk about Feel Good a bit more, which me and Katie have been really, she was last week's guest. I ended up in a relationship with her, and we're together. And now we're watching Feel Good together. We've watched five of the six episodes in the last two or three days, and it's really good. I mean, it's genuinely so impressive. Again, what we said before about showing that world and making it all seem like. That it speaks to everyone and whatever, but also the niceness of seeing a female relationship, two females relationship on TV, and it being it's the same as Schitt's Creek. Schitt's Creek didn't treat it as being anything unusual, and that's definitely didn't set out to
teach anyone anything. I think that's the best thing you can do is like.
I think
just,
that's exactly the same.
Yeah,
that, I mean, Schitt's Creek lives probably a little more in a world where absolutely nobody they meet cares about it, and no one discusses it, and that's sort of interesting. But this is sort of a bit more realistic, but it's also. But I just think like all the sort of scope of it is so grand. It feels like an American sitcom to me. And I know there's only two of you writing it. You've got all these characters. And it's almost like four or five sitcoms in one series to me, in that you've got the crazy flatmate who's, a bit wild. That could be a sitcom. You've got the family. You've got the kind of posh mates of your girlfriend, George, in it.
Narcotics Anonymous group.
Narcotics Anonymous, which again is a little bit like Loudermilk, which I was watching recently, which it's sort of similar, but you do it in a very different way. And then the comedians in the club as well, which is weirdly the only bit that isn't totally realistic. Yeah. The same comedians all yeah. in the same club. But I understand why you had to do that. Is it the Frog and Bucket? It's the Frog and Bucket, right?
Yeah, it's the Frog and Bucket in Manchester. Yeah. Which I don't know if it's closed down now, that club, but yeah, that's where we filmed. But yeah, you're right. Realistically, it should have been a revolving door of lots of different comedians, but we fudged it that it's just the same comedians every night.
Well, it wouldn't work because you get to know those characters, so it could almost be a week where they've got a week's residency. Yeah. It doesn't quite work, but no, it's nice. So it still works. But yeah, I think that sort of scope for it, but also it's a comedy drama really rather than a sitcom. Maybe I don't. It's certainly. I mean, sitcoms are allowed to be serious as well, but certainly covered. We just watched episode 5, which is the most sort of emotive and challenging one, I think. And it's brilliant. And I'd heard you, and I think last time I saw you, you'd just been an uncle. I said, "Oh, you're an uncle. You're great." And you went, "Oh, you know, I'm not really." You'd said made some disparaging comment about your own acting.
Yeah,
but you're in a cast of amazing actors in this, and you really hold your own in it.
Thanks. I think that's the trick, is surround yourself with really great, because like someone like Sophie Thompson or Lisa Kudrow, they're like, when they're looking at you and their eyes are kind of boring into you, that you don't have to do much acting because you're just in it with them, because they're like these sorceresses, you know? Yeah. So I was so nervous about acting, though. I found it so much scarier than anything I've ever done. I think because stand-up is, you're so in control. It's just a one-sided conversation. And so to be dealing with all these other people. but I loved it.
Well, but you know, but it's also, because it's not, I think some comedians go and do a sitcom and it is sort of them as a stand-up. And obviously you are a stand-up in this, but there's so much emotion to get across, because it's so much about relationships. And, you know, there's a lot of kissing and stuff to do, which I think people might find difficult and awkward. I mean, I suppose the last thing I did was in 2007, where I did a sort of comedy drama where I was in it, and I found it very difficult. I was surrounded by brilliant actors and I had to kiss someone a lot. But all I got was that I'd only written it so that I could kiss this girl, which was quite annoying because I was actually going out with the girl, so I could have kissed her anyway.
Oh, God, it's the worst when people say stuff like that, because you're like, what do you think? What a huge amount of work to go to that would have been.
Though, to be fair, kissing Charlotte Ritchie must be a pretty good perk of the job.
Oh, she's an angel, yeah. But I that was definitely an aspect of it. I was absolutely bricking it. But we did a pilot first. So we were lucky. We did this 15-minute pilot that no one will ever see. So I kind of had a chance to get over the extreme nerves of kissing someone. And then, it goes once. We rehearsed. We had a long period to sort of get comfortable with each other. And then,
those sort of sex scenes or kissing scenes are actually excruciating.
Not fit.
Because you know you're surrounded by a crew of people, first of all, but also you know, I did a few. There was sort of me falling out of a bath and stuff like that. So I was nude and some of it, but like one of the production assistants came up to me and said, "Yeah, I was just sitting in the room watching the monitor, and the monitor was just a complete close up of your penis."
No, you're gonna go.
That's a bit weird because you know you're sort of my boss, and it was so you're in this kind of quite humiliating. It's not a John Barrowman experience. It's you're not wanting to display yourself, but you can't really get away with it if you're sort of doing something like that.
Yeah, and it's like you just. What on the screen, it's this like quite tender, artistic sort of portrayal of queer love and stuff. And if you could just zoom out, and there's all these massive guys in their jackets, just bored out of their minds and wanting lunch. And then like the take ends, and you've just bared your soul, and you're half naked, and everyone's like, "Right, moving on." And you're like, "Fuck, yeah, very exposing."
Yeah, but you're great, and I've seen you talk about how. To begin with, you were sort of putting your face in the shape of what you thought the emotion was.
Do you relate to that at all?
Like, yeah, I do, because like sort of near the end of my filming, one of the actors just said, you just got to feel what the just feel the feelings.
I really thought it was just about facial expressions.
So if you just get into it and just are in the moment. I mean, I really admire actors and good actors especially. To do it really well when you are up against someone who's fantastic. Oh my god, this is, and it is sort of easier when you're up against
Yeah.
Fantastic. I have to say the Jonathan Crenshaw running joke is the one of the most enjoyable things I've seen. I really absolutely loved that. Loved that. We were really, really laughing.
Thanks. Yeah, Joe and I, my co-writer and I, have a real kind of shared sense of humor when it comes to just funny sounding words, just the sounds of words. And Hoggy Dunlop, Jonathan Crenshaw, a lot of things about wasps and worms.
I think it's just that he's always I mean, this is a fictional character who's been made up in the show, but he's always just referred to by his name. And it's never you know, it's always lightly thrown away. It's brilliant. So do look out for that if you watch it. There's a second series of this coming up.
Yeah, we filmed it in lockdown, and it's coming out really, really soon. Yeah, right. I hope people like it. It's different to season one, but same tone, I think, and same sort of scope. So, I hope, I'm excited about it.
Yeah, well, I really am. I think it's one of, but there's so, you know, there is a lot of good stuff going on now. As much as people go look back to golden ages of comedy, yeah. And you can pick out something and go, well, this isn't that good, or that isn't that good. Those things all existed in the 70s and 80s, and you've forgotten about them. There seems to be a lot of, especially female-led, there's a lot of very strong female-led sort of comedy drama within this sort of area, but they are all like inhabiting different worlds as well. So it's very exciting. And good. I'm going to ask some emergency questions.
Yes, please.
I've got some new ones.
Great.
I quite like this. I'm trying to do some Would You Rather ones. I might be doing a Would You Rather book.
Love that.
So I'll do a more comical one first. I don't know, what have I got? Would you rather have a sense of smell that could travel in time, i.e. you could smell any environment from the past or future, but not something specific. You would just go, your sense of smell would travel in time, but nothing else would. Okay. Or have a free pineapple delivered to your door every day for the rest of your life. And that will be delivered at 7 a.m. wherever you are in the world, and the people won't wake you up. It'll just be left outside your door, but there'll be a fresh pineapple waiting for you wherever you are. Or you can at your will go and sort of smell, if you wanted to smell like Henry VIII's farts or something, which I'm thinking is probably where you'd go immediately. Yeah. You wouldn't be able to go right up to his bum. You'd just be in the room when he farted, so you would get, there'd be some bleeding of other smells from the room, but you would get, and you'd get a sense, I think, of Henry VIII's fart.
I mean, it's, to me, there's no question. I'd want the smell thing. The pineapples would so quickly become a burden. It would be like the novelty would wear off so fast, and you'd start to despise them. Just that.
Okay.
I mean, I'm not a huge fan of them anyway. I'm allergic to kiwis, and I kind of lump pineapples into that family, and they sort of make me feel a bit itchy in a way. But
they're really difficult. If you get an actual pineapple, they're quite difficult to get into and eat. So I think you're right. Maybe it should be diced pineapple. You know, maybe that would be better.
Diced pineapple.
It's already diced up for you. I remember going on holiday and having a peach every morning in Italy. Like part of the breakfast buffet was like a fresh peach. And I just thought, this is the most luxurious thing in the world.
Yeah, that's
and
living.
I mean, it's nice when you're looking at the Amalfi Coast sitting outside drinking cappuccino, but just the idea of eating a peach every single morning, I think I could cope with a peach every day.
Yeah.
I occasionally do it. You can do it because they sell them in shops.
Well, if it was an Italian peach, then your life is good. But if it was a sort of woody, like scabby old British peach, I don't know. But
the fruit's off.
But we know
what would you smell?
Past...
What would you smell?
Well, the past is all going to smell one way, isn't it? It's all going to smell bad. Like, I mean, I did one of those ghost tours in Edinburgh once, and they were just talking about how they would just throw buckets of waste out the window and the streets, and it just would have been this pestilent cesspit of that. I'd really like to smell the future.
Yeah.
Really, I would love that.
How good is yours? See, I don't think my sense of smell is good enough to really get many. You know, I suppose if it's a post-apocalyptic nuclear waste nightmare, I might be able to smell that.
Yeah, you'd be able to smell if a city was burning or something. Yeah. But what else? You could. Well, apparently outer space smells like metal and steak, like cooking beef and steel. That's what outer space smells like, apparently. So
I heard the center of the universe smells of raspberries. That's what I heard.
No,
That's what I've heard.
Who told you that?
Well, I think I read it somewhere, but it was also on a podcast, but I can't remember which podcast it was that I was listening to recently. I don't think it was the No Such Thing as a Fish, who would know their stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No.
I'd love to think that was the case.
It might just be in the middle. It's raspberries. On the edge, it's steel. And steaks. But that sort of implies there's lots of burnt up aliens that are out there. Or
bloody
cows, at least.
Kind of, yeah. Well, but maybe so. Yeah. Can I smell, if I'm smelling into the future, can I do interstellar smelling? Like, can I be smelling another world?
I think we'd have to give the pineapple something. Maybe it would be a pineapple. The pineapple that if you put it up your bum, it'll cure cancer.
Yeah, something like that.
Versus that, if you want that as well. We need something spectacular for the pineapple to cope with interstellar. It would be nice to smell space and other planets. And it'd be useful because you go, there's stuff going. I can smell shit on this planet. There's life on this planet.
Yeah. Oh, God, I would love that. I bought a VR virtual reality headset all I want is the outer space ones. And there's one where you can kind of zoom through the galaxy. And I'm just, in our lifetime, I really hope we see commercial space travel, even though I'm sure that's a horrible thing to say. It's probably so bad for the environment and all that, but I want
to
get
you'll
out there.
Be able to, I think you, maybe not me, I think you'll, well, maybe we could, I think actually going into orbit will be possible if you've got a huge amount of money.
Yeah.
It'd be, there's a bit in Feel Good, isn't there, where you discuss, black holes and whether that means there'll be interstellar travel in our lifetimes. I it would be nice to think that. I don't think it's going to practically happen within our lifetime. I've been reading this book about physics recently that I didn't, quantum physics, which I didn't really understand much about, and it seems to be turning to, it goes so crazy once you get so far into quantum physics that it's just like another religion of madness of 10 dimensions and ability to travel through time and bend space and stuff.
But, it gets really mystical, doesn't it? And and abstract. And I'm really into all that stuff.
The universe is our universe is potentially just a bubble that's bubbled up, that all the conditions are right for the bubble to stay together, whereas there'll be lots of universes where because it's everything so perfect and balanced within our universe. That's the theory, is that there'd be other universes that would just pop or disappear or just have nothing in them. So the reason we're here, that there's the Big Bang, is just one of billions and billions or infinity amount
of Big Bangs,
which is just that's just we live in a big bubble.
Yeah, on the back of a turtle. And
physicists believe that everything is predictable. So therefore there's no free will, because everything's just, we're all just acting as we would act. And I think that the fact that we have consciousness and ability to make decisions warps that. I don't think decisions fall into free will, because even there was one experiment they said that they told people that free will didn't exist, or there was something like that. And those people then acted much more selfishly than the people who were told free will did exist. So they had the free will to choose.
To
behave selfishly. I think they proved that free will does exist by that. But
I really believe that if people believed that there was no free will, they would all just go mad. I'm really into all of that, like the multiple universe theories and things, or the simulation theory, and I love it all.
I mean, it seems likely to me. I think we're in a simulation, because the chances of being in a universe where everything balanced, where life is possible, where the dinosaurs got destroyed and the humans existed at all, and that we then live at this point in time, where everything is so cushy and nice, really, it's sort of so unlikely. I think we're definitely a simulation.
Yeah, I think so. It's mad, actually, that we're going around going, no, it's just a really weird fluke. That, like, it's so statistically improbable. You're right. Yeah.
Out of all the things, all the times and places and things we could have been born as, and then just even the chance of us being born from that one ejaculation that created us is still millions to one. So I reckon the Earth's been going for about 10 years everything before 10 years ago is just made, it's been implanted in our brains.
Really?
That's what I think.
Do you think it's just some geek playing Sims, basically? Yeah, it's some giant geek.
Some teenager. And there's no reason why God should be... I also think if there is a God, if someone has created it, there's no reason why they should be good. In fact, I think...
Definitely.
logically, they have to be bad, because if they were perfect, they couldn't have could you have created something imperfect from scratch? And why would you deliberately create something? If you were perfect, why would you deliberately create something that was so imperfect and full of such
so
nastiness?
Suffering and pain. Yeah. Or they must just be, if there is someone, they must just be as flawed and as we are.
I think so. I think we've sorted it out. So the universe is 10 all years right. old.
And it's some flawed geek. And
would you rather be, I think this is an interesting question. Let's see if I'm right. No, I've never asked anyone else. Would you rather be Prince William or Prince Harry?
Ooh. Oh, man, that's hard.
It is hard for lots of reasons.
Yeah.
Because neither option is particularly, you know, if I could choose something else, I would be the third thing.
Yeah.
But if I have to choose between those two, it's whether you want to be king and trapped within that family, or do you want to be free, but sort of
trapped in something else, though, maybe.
But trapped in something else. And also you've got much more freedom, I think, but you've been cut off from everything as well.
I just want a simple life. And so I think I'd pick William, actually, because I think he's got, lovely little kids, and he's, he's not sticking his head above the parapet too much. He's, I just wouldn't want the stress of being Harry. I think I'd go William.
I think I'd go for Harry, because I think they're all, and as much as I think the royal family is a ridiculous thing to still be going, I think that they're more trapped and emotionally sort of repressed as a result of being in it than he will be. I think he'll escape it. He'll do okay. They'll probably break up in about 5 years, but you know, at least he's got out of it. And then he and his kids have a shot at something resembling a normal life. It still won't be a normal life, though.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I understand it. So maybe you're right. Now I'm changing my answer, actually.
But it would be appealing to be, the idea of being king. And even though it's not, there's not any power, there's an element of power to it. And if you do it well, you could change a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go for William. I've changed. I'm going for William now.
I'm going for Harry, because I want that freedom now, and I want to meet Oprah, and I want to. Yeah, he does seem. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
Cool. That's good. And let me do one more question. One of my new questions. These are very much. Again, this might be interesting. Would you rather be the most beautiful person in the world or the cleverest person in the world? If you choose cleverness, your current attractiveness will decrease 25%. If you choose beauty, you will become 25% less intelligent.
Ooh. Well, I'm going to have to go with intelligent, but I'm not thrilled about it. I mean, but I'm not like vain in that I think I'm like, I'm sort of full of self-loathing and stuff, but I do obsess over how I look. Like, my hair is like never right. And it would force me to really, but maybe the extra intelligence would make me not value beauty at all, you know?
Yeah, I think it probably would, but do you not think like really beautiful people just get such an easy ride? It'd be interesting to be like really. I think we're both, certainly if you take 20 years off me, reasonably attractive people. Yeah. I think you're a very attractive
Thank
person.
Thank you. Thank you.
But,
ditto.
But we are not, we're not, neither of us are up there in that, those
angular Angelina Jolie type faces where you just think it's almost alien. And you're right that you get fit privilege, don't you?
Yeah, you absolutely do. I suppose it doesn't last. That's the only thing. And I suppose you, if you're always going to have it, I just think, beautiful people don't know that that's why. Maybe we don't know. Maybe we're getting loads of benefits that we don't know because we're so attractive as well. But I think they get so much extra, and people are so keen to impress beautiful people. And
that's
I don't think
so
the
true.
Same is true of intelligent people. But it would be cool to be the cleverest person in the world.
Yeah.
But
you're right. It must be a curse in a way to be insanely good looking, because you'd have such a warped sense of your own kind of worth. Because, people would just bend over backwards to like, we value it.
But also, if you're the cleverest person in the world, then no one is clever enough to really understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think in cleverness, sort of being the 100th cleverest person is probably the best. You need to be sort of clever enough that people who are listening to you think, oh, he's clever, rather than so clever that everyone goes, that's just insane. Because it's the same thing. It's like listening to physicists. It just seems insane to me what they're saying. You just say string theory and all this stuff. It just seems like you've gone crazy. This isn't a thing.
Yeah.
And you're also so clever that I can't comprehend what you're talking about.
And it's not really, that kind of hyper intelligence like that. I don't think it's that compatible with happiness. I think the more dig around, you get so overwhelmed. And yeah, my brother was talking about if there are aliens that are intelligent enough to travel interstellarly, and then there's absolutely no guarantee that they have any empathy or compassion, because they would have. Yeah, so yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, you know, we haven't got empathy and compassion for the creatures on our own planet, so, and we're the cleverest one supposedly, so there's absolutely no reason to think that they wouldn't just go fuck you. I sort of wonder whether, because if you're intelligent enough to travel the vast swathes of space, whether that would make life on other planets sort of more significant or less significant to you, because if there's stuff everywhere, you go, well, what's the point of that? Let's leave that alone. We'll go somewhere else. But if there isn't much around,
yeah,
and you have to go and find the place to go to, I don't know whether you'd have more respect for life or less respect for life if you were clever enough to be able to traverse the universe and see all the life that there must be out there.
Yeah, like I respect ants, but I wouldn't try to have a chat with one, or I wouldn't think twice about stepping on one. So
I don't even respect them. I'm gonna go as far as I wouldn't talk to them. I don't care about stepping on them, and I don't respect them. I disrespect them.
You actively disrespect them.
I absolutely do. Hey, look, I can't believe we've done so long already, but we've done about an hour, which is lovely, and it's just, you know. Let's do another. No, let's. before I forget, tell me, you're coming back and doing a stand-up show, hopefully in the autumn. Is that, or is it?
Yeah, I'm starting to sort of try things out at the end of this month, and then
great.
Yeah, and going properly on tour in the autumn. And I'm going to be really rusty.
Sap. Is it called Sap?
Yeah, it's called Sap. Yeah.
Okay.
So it might be one of those things where you pick the title way before you've written a show.
Well, Sap's quite good, because you could just make it into an acronym as well if you can't think of anything. SAP to put in.
That's a really good idea. Yeah.
Sexy and positive.
Yeah. I'm going to make sweaters that look like the Gap.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. And have you found not gigging? Is it? I mean, I know you've been doing so many other things anyway. That.
Yeah, I'm lucky. I had Feel Good to film during the pandemic, but I really miss it. Yeah, I do really miss it. I think it sort of helps me figure out who I am by doing it sort of forces you to crystallize your own opinions, and I miss the adrenaline for sure. Yeah, you
great. Yeah, I mean, I sort of haven't, you know, I think I was doing less gigs, so I haven't really gigged like doing stand-up for a couple of years anyway before lockdown. And I was concentrating on doing this, but also, you know, just spending time with my family. So I think that it's been really nice to be with my family. And I think before, if I had a couple of months off, my wife would say, go and bloody do a show somewhere.
Yeah.
I'm annoyed with you, but I think I'm sort of beyond that, so I don't think I need to do it. But yes, I'm doing some gigs in with this in May, June and July at the Clapham Grand, and it's, you know, I'm really looking forward to just even just being in the same room as the guest is enough.
Too.
But having some audience there will be awesome. And yeah, I think I haven't really wanted to think about it for fear that something else will go wrong, because like when people were last year, you know, like when gigs were getting moved last year and they were getting moved from June to September,
yeah,
I was going, we're not going to be doing this in September, you know, this is not, and you know, and there was a little brief period of time, I think in December, where we started to get like tiny little socially distanced gigs, and then it all went away again.
We've all learned this valuable lesson in not planning anything.
But no, it will be good. And I want to do a stand-up show again, I think. So if the year and everything that's happened to me has given me something to talk about, which isn't about lockdown really, but is about obviously everything else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think like I was sort of waiting to feel what would be the subject that would kind of interest me enough to do. And the book I wrote, weirdly, the book I wrote in lockdown, which I then did the audiobook of and listened to the audiobook and went, that's sort of my 2020 stand-up show.
Yeah.
And I don't think I need to go and do it as a stand-up show, but once you hear it, and the same, that's what I felt with your book as well. Once you listen to that, you go, that's, you know, it's a long stand-up show, but it's basically a stand-up show about a subject. So I think, and I made the decision in lockdown to bin all my pre-lockdown material completely. So I'm not going to ever do, unless there's some reason why in a routine that you have to refer to an old routine or something, I'm not going to do any of my stand-up, because I've just gotten to the point where
brave.
Well, I just got to the point where it's worked out okay in the gigs I've done, which have mainly been online. There's been one or two that I did in places. But, you know, you get to the point, especially when you're doing charity gigs, which was mainly what I was doing, where you've got 10 minutes. And you, I was going to say, you won't know this, but you've been doing stand-up about as long as I have. I've been doing it 30 years, but I had a big long time period off. But, you know, you just realize, oh, that joke is from 1995, and yeah. I'm still, because it's my 10 minutes, you want to keep it tight.
Yeah.
And I just thought the only way to stop myself doing that is to just say I'm never doing that stuff again. And so
you'd
I think
be really the... strict. Yeah, because you get dead behind the eyes doing it. And yeah, they can tell, and then that only makes you feel worse. So, yeah.
And I think that's what I found really interesting about this year is the risks I've taken in performing wise online, and that idea of going, right, bin it all and start again. And, you know, yeah, we're going to do some 10 minute charity gigs that are a bit awkward, yeah, which I've done. I'll get my ventriloquist dummy out after a little while if it's not going well. So,
yeah.
but actually, that's the worst bit. But yeah, no, it'll be interesting. But yeah, God, I hope it's so. It feels like it might be coming to an end.
Feels like it, but yeah, I don't want to jinx it, but yeah, I'm going to listen to your audiobook. That's amazing. Well done.
Oh, cool. Yeah. I'm really pleased with it. I'm really pleased with the way, you know, it's got it. And that's rare for me. A, it's rare for me to listen back to stuff, but B, it's rare for me to go, oh yeah, that's worked out pretty well. You know, lockdown just sort of crystallized things. Did you write your series of,
No, Feel the good. Second so series we wrote, yeah, this summer, this past yeah. summer. So, yeah, during lockdown. So, and it was kind of good, yeah.
Yeah.
So, I'm good to be just trapped in a room and no distractions and, yeah.
The only thing, because the kids were home all the time, it was really difficult to find the time to really concentrate. But my wife gave me a month at the end to kind of finish the book where she did more of the childcare. But, yeah, that was the difficult thing was that, but, you know. Enjoy not having any kids, mate.
That's good to hear because I've been feeling kind of broody. So I'm glad.
I mean, have some kids, but enjoy. I'd say do it if you want to do it.
And
if you are feeling broody,
but
really, because it's so the things that you took for granted. You know, when we now go out for a meal or something, especially after lockdown as well, definitely. So you just go, God, I used to do this. We used to do this all the time. We used to go out every night and have a meal or whatever, do whatever you want. And it's so special when you do it once every month. And that's what, you know, you think about, I think about the stand-up shows I did 10, 12, maybe 15 years ago where I was deliberately trying to antagonize the audience and annoy them. And you kind of think, God, what are the people who had kids and that was their one night out?
Oh, my God, that's such a good thing to think about. Yeah.
People enjoyed it, I think. But also, if you didn't enjoy it, if you're one of the people, this is just really, you're being really annoying. Stop being, this is, you've ruined our one.
Yeah, and you're there doing anti-comedy, kind of like really meta stuff. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, look, so very soon, a new series of Feel Good on Channel 4.
Again, no, Netflix this time.
Netflix,
so,
series
1 and 2 will both be dropping on Netflix in the UK and very, very soon.
Terrific. Yeah. And then your stand-up show, and you can go to Baymark. You've got a website.
Yeah,
Where there's bio to come or something like so. The bio is not... You know, makes my job a lot harder because then I have to go and look at another website. So think about that next time.
Yeah, I'm going to update that. Yeah.
But look, it's really been terrific to chat with you, and I'm... Matt, just such a huge fan of the TV show and the book.
Thank you.
And I'm really looking forward to the next series. So keep up all the fantastic work and the stand-up as well. So there's lots of great stuff to come. Thank you very much, Mae Martin. Next week, Felicity Ward. Thank you very much. See you. Goodbye. You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Tang, and my guest, Mae Martin. The music is by Scant Regard. I'm indebted to my friend and producer and director, Chris Evans. Not that one. You know the one I'm talking about. It's definitely not him or the other one or the Daily Telegraph one or the Politician one. It's the Go Faster Strike one. I don't know why I have to go through this every week. Thank you also to Ben Walker, and thank you for an at ACAS, British Comedy Guide, Ian Tunes, all those lot of idiots. Couldn't do it without you guys. Thank you to you, the listeners, and everyone on Twitch who watched it live. Oh, they didn't watch this one live. This one was a little secret surprise for you, wasn't it? Ooh. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. why not head to gopastthestripe.com. You can buy books and DVDs and badges. There's a page dedicated to me there now. You can see all of my stuff. richardherring.com/badges if you want to get a badge and help support our endeavours and help us make more stuff. twitch.tv/rkherring if you want to watch us do puppet shows and snooker and stuff, which I think will continue to some extent. Even when the world returns to sanity and normality, I will carry on being crazy in this attic as long as I can. Thanks for listening!
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. richardherring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.